ॐ नमो भगवते वासुदेवाय। ॐ नमो भगवते वासुदेवाय। We're reading from Srimad Bhagavatam, Canto 5, Chapter 23, Text Number 4. Do you read the Sanskrit or just the English? Kecha naita jyotir anikam shishumara samstanena bhagavato vasudevasya yoga Darayanam anuvatanayanti. Translation. This great machine consisting of the stars, planets, and planets resembles the form of a Shishumara dolphin in the water. It is sometimes considered an incarnation of Krishna, Vasudeva. Great yogis meditate upon Vasudeva in this form because it is actually visible. I would like to, because some of you haven't been here yesterday, I think, I would like to read the previous verse also one more time to get the context of this verse. When the bulls are yoked together and tied to a central post to thresh rice, they tread around that pivot without deviating from their proper position, one bull being closest to the post, another in the middle, and a third on the outside. Similarly, all the planets and all their hundreds and thousands of stars revolve around the pole star, the planet of Maharaj Dhruva, in their respective orbits, some higher and some lower, fastened by the Supreme Personality of Godhead to the machine of material nature. According to the results of their fruitive acts, they are driven around by the pole, around the pole star by the winds, and will continue to be so until the end of creation. These planets float in the air within the vast sky, just as clouds with hundreds of tons of water float in the air, or as the great Siena eagles, due to the results of past activities, fly high in the sky and have no chance of falling to the ground. Now one more time, verse 4. This great machine consisting of the stars and planets resembles the form of a Shishumara, dolphin in the water. It is sometimes considered an incarnation of Krishna Vasudeva. Great yogis meditate upon Vasudeva in this form because it is actually visible, purported by Srila Prabhupada. Transcendentalists such as yogis whose minds cannot accommodate the form of the Lord prefer to visualize something very great, such as the Virata Purusha. Therefore, some yogis contemplate this imaginary Shishumara to be swimming in the sky, the way a dolphin swims in water. They meditate upon it as the Virata Rupa, the gigantic form of the Supreme Personality of Godhead. So this whole chapter canto has been dealing with the structure of the cosmic manifestation and how in a wonderful way the cosmic order is being maintained by laws which material scientists try to term different names, like Prabhupada mentions gravity, different forces of nature. But he's always pointing out the great defect. It is not enough simply to recognize some laws, as scientists do, laws of physics or laws of nature. But more important than that is to recognize the lawgiver. So that is the great defect of modern science. Previously, in previous ages, actually just until a few hundred years back, there was no separation between science and religion. As a matter of fact, the greatest religionists were simultaneously the greatest scientists in all religion. This is true for Hindu religion. Brahmins were studying scripture, worshipping Krishna, and at the same time studying material nature. With the perspective of the Supreme Personality of Godhead. The same is true in Jewish religion. Great Jewish scholars of ancient times studied material nature in order to perceive the presence of God, the wonder of creation that God had manifested in this world. The same is true with Islamic scholars till Middle Ages, we might say. The greatest Islamic leaders were also scholars who would study the Quran and at the same time recognize the beauty and wonder of the creation of God's creation. And also it is true for Christian theologians, especially till the Middle Ages, till the 1500s, actually even to some degree still today, especially in some orders like the Jesuits. They were very famous. They were monks, Christian monks. But basically what they did is, with very great scientific understanding and very high-quality research, they were studying material creation and the laws of nature, but from a perspective of a theistic worldview. So then last night, Prabhuji was giving this class on there is Krishna consciousness and paradigm shift. So the same thing took place in the midst 1500s, at least in Europe. There was a change of paradigm. Until that time, practically speaking, you might say, at least in Western countries, here in India you had Mayavadis and Buddhists. So you had some atheistic philosophies already here for some centuries. But practically speaking, the rest of the world, Islamic world, Western world, Christian world, you might say there was not a single atheist. Everyone believed in God. Even the simplest man, if he had no education, if he was illiterate, he had firm faith in God. He would understand that the whole creation is coming from God. So then there was a shift. Something happened, paradigm shift. From a theocentric worldview, ultimately to what we have nowadays, an egocentric worldview. And it started very gradually, actually by well-meaning men. The first scientist to actually discover some phenomena, like Galileo, Copernicus, and Newton, great astronomers and professors of physics. They were actually theists. They had firm faith in God. But actually what they started, it was the beginning, so to say, of what 200 years later developed in what we call nowadays materialism. So with the shift, until that time, actually until the 1500s, the people had the worldview that the earth was the center of the universe and it was created by God and everything was meant to be used, that is to say, under the direction of God. Then out of a sudden there was a shift. The earth was not anymore considered the center of the universe. The sun was considered the center of the universe and the earth was revolving around the sun. So this shift, this little shift in consciousness, it brought about eventually a change that the whole center of, let's say, existence, perception, and philosophy was shifted away from God towards a self-centered, egocentric worldview. So in the same, around the same time, in 1600s, there was a big German philosopher, Kant. He wrote a book, The Critic of Pure Reason, which was later on from, but Kant even also, you might say, he was still to a point theistic. But from that philosophy of reason, it was later on developed in the beginning 19th century, late 18th century, beginning 19th century by another famous German philosopher, Hegel, into what is known as dialectical materialism. And that was basically the beginning, this shift, to what we call dialectical materialism. It simply took away all the phenomena, all the laws that we see existing, all the phenomena in the world, from the fact that they have been established by a superior power, by a superior entity, simply to a mechanical system of thesis, antithesis, the two opposites interact with one another, creating a synthesis, which again is the basis for a new thesis. Again, another antithesis is developed. The two again interact with one another, and in this way, by this dialectical interaction, material existence is continuing and going on. So basically, that was the start of seeing the world simply as a mechanical machine. Here it is also described as a machine. But this type of machine, it took out the controller of the machine, the creator of the machine. It simply took it as a machine which was practically on perpetual motion without any outside spiritual or divine control. That started basically dialectical spiritualism, materialism, excuse me. From there, the next step, next personality, was Darwin. He actually took the same principle, material nature interacting in a dialectical way, from the physical level to the biological level. So he was saying life originated from interaction of chemicals. Eventually, chemicals combined to such complexity that life was formed. Then from the first life forms, some mutations appeared. Again, through some interaction of chemicals, some new life form originated. And then as different life forms evolved, again, they interacted in a way of opposites, so to say, interacting who is stronger, who is weaker, the survival of the fittest, the struggle for existence. And in this way, the law of theory of evolution was put into place. So life simply being a combination of chemicals evolving through a constant exchange of material energies to higher and higher states, and excluding those or eliminating those of inferior quality. That was one branch. The next branch, which was coming out of Hegel's philosophy of dialectical spiritualism, directly connected, a continuation of this philosophy was Karl Marx's communism, which basically took the same principle of biological struggle for existence or survival of the fittest, or the battle of, or the struggle for existence on a social and political level. So instead of species competing, there we had the struggle, we had the struggle of one species against another. Now with Marx we have the same principle, one class against another. Capitalist class against working class. So in this way, this materialism became more and more established as an ideology of the time. Another feature of it, very prominent, as actually you might see that these three are representing there, the beginning of, practically speaking, the rise of atheism throughout the whole world. The third one was Freud. He was a psychologist. He studied, until that time, the human psyche was not systematically studied. At least not, I'm sure in Brahminical culture or in Buddhist culture, there's also a very intricate study of the mind. But in Western culture, that was not done. There was previously, prior to Freud, there was practically no study of the mind. But Freud also was an atheist. Even so, he was of Jewish descent, but Marx also was of Jewish descent, but they actually were atheists. So his conclusion was, his sum and substance of his philosophy was that all mental disorder, that all mental problems, all distress, mental distress, all depression, all unhappiness only has one source, which is unfulfilled sexual desire. He reduced, practically speaking, the whole of human existence to one purpose. And his whole approach to helping people with psychology. Nowadays, this has also been reversed. He has been obsolete, actually, in the psychiatric world. But practically speaking, for a century, that paradigm was law. That practically speaking, all mental problems, the reason why people are unhappy is not because they have lost their spiritual culture or because they have lost their connection with God, but because they have not had happy sex life. That was his conclusion. And these three personalities, with these three philosophies, evolution theory, Marxism, communism, and Freudian psychology, have ruined the entire human society. As a result of it, I might say, we have seen this in this Srimad Bhagavatam. Prabhupada several times severely criticizes modern atheistic scientists. But in a much more pronounced way, he has done this in a series of morning walks, which were conducted in Los Angeles, sometimes in the beginning 1970s, I think 1972, with a group of devotees, amongst them Swarup Damodar Swami. He was a PhD in chemistry, so he was one of the, actually nowadays we have so many doctors and lawyers and trained and skilled, highly educated academic people in this congregation. At that time it was very rare. He was an Indian, you know him, Indian gentleman who had settled in America, had received his degree in chemistry. So as a result of Prabhupada being there, some very interesting series of discussions occurred on this topic, modern science, evolution, different perspectives, worldviews, etc. And these talks have been published in a book called Life Comes from Life. Now, what you have here, maybe some of you have read this book. Have some of you read this book, Life Comes from Life? Okay. I must tell you, this book which you have here, it is a very wonderful book. It is very good for preaching. But the editors who have published it in the American BBT have taken out, I must say, maybe 1/4 or 1/3 of Prabhupada's statements. The book was originally published in German language by Hansa Dutta Prabhu. He was the GBC in Germany. He had the original transcripts from those morning walks. The book was first published in German, then later on in English. And the Hansa Dutta, he had like a very, how do you say, Kshatriya-type nature, revolutionary-type nature, so he didn't care. So he printed it as Prabhupada said it. And the words Prabhupada used in this book, if you would, I wish that you would have the chance to read this in its actual version, without the passages taken out. I'm not criticizing that it was taken out because it is actually proper for book distribution. It's the difference when Prabhupada talks intimately with devotees on a particular to instruct them. That cannot always be taken and given out for the mass public. That's understood. But for the devotees, it would be much better if they would read the original version. Because nowhere, there's no other book where you can experience such intensity of anger that Prabhupada is expressing than in these conversations against these rascal scientists, as he would call them. He would use words. I tell you the truth, one time I was in a, I talk about it this afternoon, and I will just mention it. I had some spare time, let's say, like this. And during this time, I was taking this book, and I went through the whole book, I made marks, and I took out all those statements where Prabhupada made what they call categorical imperatives. I don't know, is that understood? When Prabhupada says, do like this, you should do that, This should be done like this. This is called categorical imperatives. I wrote down 7 pages of statements like this out of this book. And those categorical imperatives, the Prabhupada said, those among those words were, kick them in the face, beat them with a shoe. They should be beaten with a shoe. They should be kicked in the face. And like very strong, with real, let's say, divine anger. So sometimes people are surprised that spiritual personalities exhibit such capacity of anger, of such intense anger, to the point of actually saying to beat somebody or kick him. We have a similar example in the Christian tradition. Some of you may have some background or some knowledge. Lord Jesus Christ, when he was preaching in Palestine during the 3-year period, I mean, he is known in the whole world as the most tolerant person. He allowed himself to be crucified. He didn't complain once. Opposite, his teaching was, amongst his teaching, if there is an enemy or somebody inimical to you, you should love him. Love your enemies. Do good to those who hate you. That was his teaching, because his disciples were asking him, because they're also similar as nowadays Krishna conscious movement. They were like an odd group, so to say, amongst the Jewish people. Not everybody liked them. Like Jesus also, he was very much criticized by the established religion, the Pharisees of that time. They actually ultimately killed him, not the politicians, not the Romans. He was killed because of his own countrymen, of his own religion. The Pharisees, they actually accused him. And so his disciples asked him, how tolerant should we be? They're always harassing us. Then he said, you should be, like same as Lord Chaitanya practically said, you should be more tolerant than a tree, devoid of false prestige, more tolerant like a blade of grass. So that was his teaching. But once, there's an astounding story in the Bible. He went to the temple, and in front of the temple, or practically we're here, like here, that if you come into the temple room, there were money lenders. So money lending was simply because also, like sometimes you have here, the people think that they can buy themselves spiritual life. They simply by giving some dakshin or doing some offering, some atonement is there or some whatever. So these fellows, they had become so expert, they simply had made a system that they would practically increase the guilt feeling of the people to such a degree so that they would, when they would come to the temple, in order for them to atone, they made them give huge sums of money, not for the purpose of spreading God consciousness, but simply for putting it in their own pocket. So they had become money lenders and practically speaking, making a business out of religion. So this was intolerable for Jesus. It says, described, he went in there, he threw the tables over. All the coins were scattering all over the floor. He took a stick, he was smashing on them with a stick, he was kicking them. This most peace-loving and, non-violent person, he became so enraged. Why? Because he was enraged by the fact that the people were cheating of their real religion by some false religion, some money-making scheme in the name of religion. So that was same we find in Prabhupada's this type of anger. So then, maybe if you don't mind, I read just one or two quotes. Yesterday on the farm, I had a little time, and I read you just even in this edited edition, there is a few quotes left, which make that point. So Prabhupada says, Actually, such scientists are rascals. They childishly say that life came from matter, although they are not at all able to prove it. Our Krishna consciousness movement should expose all these rascals. Then, everyone is suffering here in the material world, and scientific improvement means that the scientists are creating a situation of further suffering. That's all. They are not making any improvements. By so-called scientific improvement, the scientist has become an ass. Moreover, he is becoming a better and better ass, and nothing more. Then, most important statement. Almost everyone in the world is under the false impression that life is born from matter. We cannot allow this nonsensical theory to go unchallenged. Life does not come from matter. Matter is generated from life. This is not theory, it is fact. Science is based on incorrect theory, therefore all these calculations and conclusions are wrong, and people are suffering because of this. When all these mistaken modern scientific theories are corrected, people will become happy. So we must challenge the scientists and defeat them. Otherwise, they will mislead the entire society. So this is some very, tongue-in-cheek expressions that probably the others are much more, I tell you, much more heavy than this. So the fact is, like I said before, these materialistic philosophies of evolution theory, materialism, especially in the form of nationalism, communism, and sexual freedom. They have caused so much suffering, not only from a spiritual point of view, because they have killed the natural inclination of the living being to worship God, but also from a material point of view. If you examine the past century, the 20th century, it was a century of unprecedented violence, where hundreds of millions of people have been killed as a result of these atheistic ideologies through National Socialism in Germany, through communism. Stalin incarcerated 1/7 of the entire Russian population. Millions of people have been killed in the Second World War. 20 million people have been killed in the Second World War. Mao Zedong, the same. 50 million Chinese people have been killed as a result of this application of this atheistic demoniac philosophy in China. And as a result of Freud's sexual freedom, the moral principles have declined everywhere. The family tradition has been lost, and the end result of it is hundreds of millions of children who are being killed in the womb. So therefore, Krishna consciousness, Prabhupada was stressing so much the need to make propaganda against it. He actually sometimes, in this original version of this Life Comes From Life book, I think at least 100 times he used the word propaganda. We must make propaganda against this. There was one quote I remember where he said that we are worshipping Krishna is our internal affair. Externally, we have to make propaganda against these demoniac philosophies and scientists. Because the natural tendency of the living entity, like we said before, it is totally unnatural. This state of atheism is the most unnatural state of human existence. Because if you see creation, even a child or even the most primitive tribe, we have some tribes in the world, they have never seen a white man or any modern amenities or anything. But still, even the most primitive of society, there will be a recognition that there is a higher power which manifests itself through the agents of nature, the sun, the wind, the thunder, the lightning. They will, if necessary, because they have no better knowledge, they will worship a tree, they will worship some stone, they will worship simply out of the recognition, there must be something above me, there must be something greater than me that is putting these forces upon me. And a child can understand this. A dog can understand this. Prabhupada was giving the example. When there is thunder and lightning, the dog will put his tail between his legs in fear, because he will be in awe and fear of that superior power which is controlling his life. And then if you study a little further, if those who have intelligence, nowadays actually with our modern facilities, it is possible, we have microscopes, we can see in minute particles. With we have telescopes, we can see the vastness of the sky. So we can, with the modern scientific facilities, we can discover the most miraculous aspects of creation. If you take a cell, just one cell, like according to Darwin, when he started his theory, in order to justify that life comes from matter, he was saying a cell is nothing but simply two or three amino acids combined. They some or another combined, and then boom, there's life. Very simple thought. But nowadays, with modern science, we can actually look inside the cell. What we find? One cell, one tiny cell, of which we have billions and billions in our body, is more complex than the entire complexity of Mumbai or New York City. There is electrical energy department. There are taxis, transportation departments. There is police departments. Sometimes, like here in Mumbai, you have places, rickshaws cannot come in. You cannot enter. You have to only go outside. So in the same, in the cell, there are some departments. Certain things cannot enter. Other things, they knock at the door at the cell. Who are you? Oh, yeah, you are allowed to come in. Very complex, intricate arrangements, transportation systems, energetic systems, chemical plants. Did you know that the human body, from this one cell, is producing in excess of 5 million different chemicals? It is unbelievable. One cell, we are all coming from this one single cell. When the sperm is mixing with the egg, it forms one cell. Then this cell, after a few hours, the most miraculous thing will happen. It will split in half. Out of a sudden, it will contract in the middle, and then it will make an exact carbon copy duplicate of itself. But remember, already this first cell, it has a complexity like a gigantic, big 13 million people city. It's not simple at all. Within an hour, it will create an equivalent of another 30 million people city. Then, after a few days later, I'll give you an example. This is just as miraculous. If you walk on the street, out of a sudden you see a car contracting in the middle, and within 2 or 3 minutes, the same car is there duplicated one more time. One car has become two cars. Then 3 minutes later, those two cars have become four cars. Unbelievable. But then even some most wonderful thing is happening. After a few days, not only do they sell the stems, in the beginning they are stems, what we call stem cell, not only do they duplicate exactly the replica, out of a sudden one cell is creating a completely different cell. From the stem cell, out of a sudden there is a muscle cell, then there is a nerve cell, they're all different. If you analyze your different parts of your body, they are not the same. The nerve cell is entirely different from your muscle cell. Your lung cells are completely different from the rest. Your kidney cells are again completely different. Every organ of your body, kidneys, spleen, etc., brain, have all very bones, teeth. It's all coming from that one original cell in so many different varieties. The most amazing thing is it creates an eye cell. Here we have, in the beginning, I mean, this is flesh. You cannot see through. Bone, you cannot see through. Then that cell, one cell, which was like a lump of flesh, you might say, is duplicating, and out comes an eye cell, how to say, the lens of your eye, which is perfectly clear. It is the most perfect precision optical instrument existent, all coming from the same cell. So how is it possible that all these wonderful, intricate, orderly, intelligent arrangement is coming simply by chance combination of some chemicals, as these scientists try to make us believe? Those of you, we have some doctors here. Can we see some hands who are doctors? So many. So during your medical study, one of your studies must have been immune system. The immune system is the most miraculous thing. It is indescribable, the capacity of the immune system. Just imagine. Like I said before, the human body can produce various ways, hormones, enzymes, so many different things, 5 million different types of chemicals. The immune system, this particular cell, which has this specific function to protect the body from harmful intruders, microbes, bacteria, viruses, etc., poisons even. What this T cell is capable of, when some organism is entering the body, which has never had any contact with this organism before, first contact, within hours, first it is analyzing what is this entity, what is this organism, what is its characteristic, what is its specialty. It analyzes all the different aspects. Then it makes a master plan. How can I counter-react it? Within hours, it has done all these calculations, analysis and calculation, plus it has produced, out of this 5 million chemicals, a substance that will perfectly match to counter-react this one intruder and destroy it. I was hearing one radio program by some doctor in Germany. He said the immune system can create, out of these different arrangements of these substances produced in the body, 20 million different combinations of antibodies within the shortest period of time. Sometimes we see, like some people in the past, like some diseases, like HIV. For years and years, if some new disease comes, big research scientists with billion-dollar budgets, with hundreds and thousands of professors, have to work day and night, day and night, day and night, to come up with some medicine or some vaccine. And all this, which the medical or the research or pharmaceutical profession is taking years to do, the T cell would do within a few hours. Miraculously, so many miracles. If you study any part of creation, you will find the same miracular power. If you examine the eye, it is a pure wonder of engineering. If you examine the process of hearing, it is the most miraculous thing you can imagine. Every aspect. Or take another example. Some of you study biology. There's some biology students here or majors. Another example is for example, amongst the animal kingdoms, we have the miracle of these migrating animals, like, for example, bird migration or salmon migration. Or did you know that every year in excess of 50 billion birds are migrating? The whole, just like we have nowadays, we have an internet, or we have a net of, for example, if you see the airplanes, if you would make lines, how the different airlines fly over the world, you could draw the same type of grid from the different migrating birds. Some of them, within 1 year, one direction, some people think they only go for a few hundred kilometers, maybe 2,000 or 3,000 kilometers, which some do. Some are migrating small distances, some medium distances. Some birds migrate in one journey 25,000 kilometers. One way and another 25,000 kilometers back. Some birds fly 3,000, 4,000, 5,000 kilometers without ever stopping once, without ever touching the ground once. They just, and some of them, their weight is only a few grams. Where do they get the energy to fly thousands of kilometers nonstop? But the most amazing thing is their ability to navigate. Not only do they go, let's say we have migrating birds in Germany, and they figured, well, it's going to get cold sometime, so we better go south. It's not as simple as that. They go to one specific location. They will start flying in Germany. This, not only once, year after year after year after year. They will start on one tree or in one house in Germany, fly 7,000 kilometers to one specific tree. In that tree they have been the year before. They have studied all this. They have some biologists have actually attached satellite, they have connected, electrodes, so they could trace, nowadays with modern equipment, they have traced that birds are flying year after year to the exact tree in the exact same forest, thousands of kilometers away. Some birds start flying in the northeastern part of Siberia, fly all the way down to the southernmost part of Africa. Some birds, curiously enough, start practically flying from almost like the North Polar regions to almost to the South Polar regions, for whatever reason. But they make this whole trip. Not only do they find exactly the same space, they do this on time, like a clock. In some cities in Germany, if you wouldn't have a calendar, if you would see that particular bird coming back, you would know what date it is. They're coming back exactly on the same date, even though the traveling conditions are different every time. You know, sometimes, just like an airplane, you take a trip. If there's a strong countercurrent, the plane will have some delay because the winds, the front winds or tail winds or whatever. If you have a lot of front wind, the airplane cannot fly so fast. It will have 2, 3, 4 hours delay. So the same conditions apply to the birds. They also sometimes have different winds, whatever. But the miracle is they will arrive exactly on time. You could practically tell your clock on it. And this is not only true for birds. This migrating phenomena is there with fish, salmon, they also do. For years they go in the ocean, then they come back to the place where they have taken birth. And penguins, recently we saw this documentary on penguins. It's the most amazing thing in the Antarctica. They have a penguin population, so all around the Antarctica. Exactly the same thing. They have no contact or communication, as we might say, like cellular phones or internet or whatever. But wherever they are on the Antarctica, at one particular time, actually, first they resemble. They wait for days, actually. They are different congregations, you might say. They resemble in a field. Then out of sudden, as if somebody would have given a starting, they start marching. And they have one place on the Antarctica where year after year, those penguins come together, like they make a big penguin mela. They all come together in one spot from all directions. And again, the amazing thing is, even so, they're coming from different directions. And from their navigational point of view, you might say, their surrounding is constantly changing because the ice formations are not, it's not like rock formation. They are changing. They're unstable. Sometimes there was an ice formation there and then it's not there anymore. But they will perfectly find that one spot. And the amazing thing is, all of them from all the different directions arrive the same day. So, how can you say there is no superior intelligence in control? Even a child can understand this. And this is what, is so important to promote, to pass on. Now here, Prabhupada, there are so many students we have seen yesterday. I must say, I was completely mind-blown to see all these young students who come here to chant Hare Krishna and take up Krishna consciousness. This is what Prabhupada wanted. He wanted the intelligent class of men to take up Krishna consciousness. So with their intelligence, they can explain these facts, this truth, these wonderful, miraculous things that actually nowadays with modern science we can actually document in such a perfect way to the people so that their God consciousness will be revived. That's what Prabhupada wanted. Then, one more aspect. We might think, if we have talked, let's say, in such a negative way about modern science, that one might misunderstand that Krishna consciousness is against technology. That is not a fact. They are two different things. The technology is not bad, just like science is not bad. It is the perspective with which science is being conducted and for what technology is being used. I must relate to you one experience, one realization I had, which was very profound for me. First I tell you the realization, then I tell you how I got to it. It is not a coincidence that the appearance of Lord Chaitanya coincides practically exactly with the invention of the printing press. At that time when Lord Chaitanya descended, Krishna gave the intelligence to one person, Gutenberg, you should invent the printing press. We need this 500 years later, we have to print Prabhupada books. It's a fact. So, I tell you how I got this realization, that there is a connection between the two historical incidents. Normally, we would not necessarily connect the two. Printing press, Lord Chaitanya, I don't know, worlds apart, the one in Germany, the other one in Bengal, but at the same time. You know how I got this realization? I was in charge with the BBT in Germany for first 4 or 5 years, from 1971 till 1976. When we printed our Mother Surabhi, she was there at that time. When we printed, after some difficult start, we actually had sufficient money to print the first of Prabhupada's book in German. We had received some Ishupanishad from America, German books, but then we had money and we printed our first German book. And it was, if I can remember correctly, what we called Die Quelle absoluten Wissens, the source of absolute knowledge. On the cover was a black cover and it had a beautiful picture of Radha and Krishna, because Radha and Krishna, they are the source of absolute knowledge. So this printing company where we printed this book, it was on the border between Germany and Denmark, Flensburg, right at the border. So at that time, Denmark, they are a very, free-thinking people, Danish people. So before it hit anywhere else, later on it spread everywhere, but before it was spreading anywhere else, the Danish people were the first ones to mass publish pornography, pornographic books and pornographic magazines. So I went to the printer in this to see how our printing was progressing, and there it was, on one printing machine, there was printed the picture of the epitome of divine love, Radha and Krishna. On the next printing machine, right next to it, was the lowest of its perversion, some pornographic magazines being printed at the same time. So then I had this realization. This printing machine, it has, how to say, just like it has been created for printing Prabhupada's books. And that they are practically available, so Krishna has to give some incentive to the materialistic scientists to come up with the material inventions. And so they, of course, have their ulterior purposes and usages for that. But they will all, that will all disappear, just like it says in Bhagavad Gita. That which is unreal has no permanence. And that which is real is permanent. So you can print 1 million pornographic magazines on the printing press. The next week they will end up in the garbage can. They have no permanence. It doesn't really matter if they're printed or not. It has no existence. But to print Prabhupada's books, print Bhagavatam, Bhagavad Gita, or Prabhupada's, these books will go on for eternity. And then I realized this machine has been invented simply for this reason. Just like I give you another example. Just like Lord Buddha appeared. Like I was saying before, that Prabhupada was so strongly preaching against actually three things. Mayavadi philosophy, fake religion or cheating religion, and atheistic scientists. He would get furious about those, because of the suffering these three groups of people caused. So in one sense, Buddhism also is impersonalist philosophy. It denies God. But from another perspective, we can understand. Lord Krishna appeared as Lord Buddha in a particular historical context to counter-react the fact that the temples had become slaughterhouses under the pretext of Vedic sacrifices by degenerated brahmanas. So in order to achieve that, he had to take this step. To stop this killing of animals, he had to take this measure. Then later on, the founder of Mayavadi philosophy, to which Prabhupada, so strongly objects, Sankaracharya appeared. But he's part of this greater plan of Krishna. Because everything in this creation is under the control of God. Like Krishna said, not even a blade of grass can move without my sanction. I direct all the wanderings of moving and non-moving beings. And everyone is following my path without exception. Even the demons, even the atheists, even the atheistic scientists, he can only do what Krishna allows him to do. And if Krishna, there's also in Bhagavad Gita we heard, Krishna says, I am the intelligent in man. I am the ability in man. For me comes knowledge, alone comes knowledge, remembrance, and forgetfulness. So when some scientist is capable of inventing some machine, it is so because Krishna has allowed him to do so. And there is some purpose behind it. So just like there was some purpose in Sankaracharya's appearance, because by him, the Indian culture was again based on Vedic knowledge. He closed the gap that had been taken, opened by Buddhist philosophy. He returned the philosophical basis of the scholars to the Vedic conception in an impersonal way, but it was again back to the Vedic conclusion. Then, of course, came Ramanuja Acharya, Madhva Acharya, and in the end, Lord Chaitanya and the whole circle was closed. But Buddha and Shankaracharya, they were necessary steps in this progression. So in the same way, it is not a coincidence that at the time of Lord Chaitanya, this is the beginning of what we would call, this materialistic philosophy to spread. Why? Why was this, what is the connection? The reason being, the facilities that we have today, because Lord Chaitanya, Krishna, he's not making 1 month plan, 1 year plan, 5 year plan. He's making 500 year plan. He's making 10,000 year plan. Right? We have this, we say, this Kali Yuga, there will be 10,000 years of Krishna consciousness. So this is the time frame in which Krishna thinks, Lord Chaitanya thinks. So they could foresee, unless there will be some technology in the future, the Krishna consciousness will not be able to spread all over the world. If there was no ship, if there's no aeroplane, how will Prabhupada come to the Western world? In order to bring Krishna consciousness to the rest of the world, there has to be a ship, there has to be aeroplane. That Prabhupada, within 12 years' time, can establish a movement all over the world. There has to be an aeroplane. So what does Krishna do? He will tell some in the heart, from the heart, some demoniac, proud, materialistic scientist, go on, go for that Nobel Prize. You should get it. You invent that aeroplane. So then that the devotee can use and spread Krishna consciousness. Same as the printing press. Same as we had here the wonderful movie. Now we have DVDs that can be distributed. Just think about it, how wonderful. Previously, the life of a saint like Lord Jesus, after he had passed away, generations after him, nobody could see or hear him. Now for generations, for the next hundreds or how many years, people will still be able to see Srila Prabhupada and hear Srila Prabhupada's voice. 70s DVDs with movies from Srila Prabhupada. That's only possible because some determined, ambitious scientist studied quantum physics and he developed laser technology and he got this Nobel Prize. And he's very proud. But, so let them hear all the Kami songs and all the Kami movies if they want. But the real purpose why this machine is invented, not for that. It was invented so that Krishna consciousness and Prabhupada can be seen and heard hundreds and hundreds of years from now. This is the purpose. So, if you understand like this, then we can see all the different things that are being, the facilities are being provided. We should see, that was Prabhupada's philosophy. You make the best use of everything in the service of Krishna. He was giving the example of the mouse and the snake. He said, the mouse will dig a hole and build himself some kind of cozy little place where he feels like real home, at home. Wonderful. Very comfortable. Then the snake will come. He will crawl inside that path. He go inside, eat the mouse, and live in the place. So this is how devotees should do. Let them invent all these machines and all these technologies, and then let us use the same thing to defeat them. That is the vision that Srila Prabhupada had. So I would like to read one more time because it is such a profound statement. This just one paragraph, and maybe we can meditate how we can apply this in our preaching. Prabhupada always encouraged us as his disciples to write articles, to challenge. He actually, many times he would say, also in this book, challenge them. There's also a very nice discourse where Hansa Dutta, when he was in Sri Lanka, maybe you have read. It's in the end. It's actually in the American version at the end of this book, the discourse between Dr. Cavour, atheistic science doctor, and Hansa Dutta. So he challenged and he completely defeated them. So we should think like this: how we can fulfill Prabhupada's, how to say, if desire in that regard. It's one thing, actually, like for example, there's nothing worse you can do if you make a man angry, right? Like if somebody makes your father angry, or if somebody makes your loved one angry, then you become even more motivated to take some action than simply on some other issue. So this is the issue which has made Prabhupada most furious, lion-like. So we should take up that issue because it is so, it's so pressing to Prabhupada. And he says, almost everyone in the world is under the false impression that life is born from matter. We cannot allow this nonsensical theory to go unchallenged. Life does not come from matter. Matter is generated from life. This is not theory, it is fact. Science is based on an incorrect theory. Therefore, all its calculations and conclusions are wrong. And people are suffering because of this. When all these mistaken modern scientific theories are corrected, people will become happy. So we must challenge these scientists and defeat them. Otherwise, they will mislead the entire human society. This we should see. Those of you who can write, they should write. Those we have seen, we have filmmakers, I don't know if he's still here. Those we have some very talented filmmakers, Yadava Prabhu and this devotee from Argentina, from Spain. If we can make movies and films like this, nowadays with all this animation technology, it is very, you can very graphically show in so many convincing ways these subject matters. And those intelligent students, especially here in India, because the intelligence is not spoiled completely by Sanskritification yet. In our Western countries, to a large degree, unfortunately, to the constant bombardment with Sanskritification and intoxication, etc., to some degree, the intelligence is already lost. But here it is still there. So if you can take up that challenge, that would be very great. Hare Krishna. Any question or comment?
First of all, well, thank you very much for your class. It was completely in line. And back to the point you mentioned of this, the discourses that Prabhupada had, that they were deleted. That you found these Prabhupada's, they weren't published in the book.
Were published in the German edition, but not in the English edition.
But they weren't published in the widely read book. I always love it when Prabhupada gets really fired up. I kind of get fired up myself, so I kind of fall in that same mood. And my question is, reiterating your point of we should, now's the time to use all points to defeat these rascals. And when I hear that they exist, those points that aren't widely available, I want to know where are they, who's got them, and how can we get them?
Well, I have several copies of the German Life Comes from Life at home. If somebody can translate, that's... Because maybe sometimes I can make some excerpts.
Oh, please do. Please do.
But like I said, I think it was quite adequate. I am not at all in disagreement that for the distribution of this book to the public, those things have been taken out. They would have been completely misunderstood because they were not spoken in a context for public audience. But they were spoken for a very specific audience to the devotee, to actually instruct and enthuse the devotees. That was Prabhupada's mood. But those particular words, they were not meant simply for mass distribution. Yeah. The way this has been done is actually very nice, because if somebody reads this book, he will get all the good arguments, but without those, let's say, fiery statements. Yeah. So this is very wonderful. I think this is one of the most wonderful books to distribute for introducing an inquisitive person to Krishna consciousness. But like I said, for the devotees, I think it would be nice if there would be a facility to get actually read the original transcript.
I also, that's my point. I think in-house to inspire, to excite, to reiterate Prabhupada's passion of this point.
Yeah, you get that feeling of that passion. I mean, Prabhupada was a 75-year-old man. Just by reading it, you get such a feeling of that passion that Prabhupada had for this topic, for this subject matter.
So you'll make available for you?
I will.
Thank you.
Okay, any other?
Thank you very much for a very fascinating class. The question I had is this, that the face of science keeps changing. The tools of science and technology also keep changing. And if the devotees have to spend their time to understand the intricacies of new inventions and science just to be able to preach, would it achieve the desired result? This is the question I had in my mind. Because the devotees would have to spend time to understand what the scientists are doing. And wouldn't they be sort of not utilizing their time properly just to be able to understand what the scientists are doing? And all the time the scientists are doing something or the other. So if that becomes our tool.
You can boil it down to these three principles. Therefore, I said in the beginning, it's actually not that complicated to study this. You won't have to spend years and years and years to understand these points. I can recommend to you to read this book. Another very interesting book which I can recommend in this regard is a similar discourse on that took place between Hayagriva Prabhu, another devotee, and Srila Prabhupada on the different philosophers. Because there was also the need felt that as we are being, so to say, misled by materialistic scientists, also the different philosophies that is existing. So there was some discourse. Systematically, actually the devotee, Hayagriva, he would play the devil's advocate, so to say. He would take the position of a particular philosopher and expound his particular philosophy, and then Prabhupada would give his counter-arguments. So the whole book is maybe 30, 40 different, including Marx, including Mao Zedong, including Aristotle, the Greek philosophers, the classical German philosophers, etc. It's a very interesting book. It has been published under the name Dialectical Spiritualism, connecting it to the exact opposite dialectical materialism. So just like Prabhupada would call Krishna consciousness spiritual communism, so also there is something like dialectical spiritualism. And it's very interesting to study that. No, you don't have to spend your whole life, but in one sense, what I have said today, a child can understand this. It is not, you don't have to be, a Nobel Prize winner to understand what I was explaining about the bird migration or the cell or whatever. So with a little research, maybe a little reading, you can have all the arguments in the world. And then the rest is simply your attitude. It is not that the knowledge or the reason is not there. It is simply because these people, nowadays actually to some degree it is changing. More and more even famous scientists are coming to the conclusion that evolution and all these things is completely rubbish. It is so obvious, so crystal clear, a child could understand it. So, like, there are scientists like Paul Davies, for example, Rupert Sheldrake, Michael Talbot. They have, there's some very good literature already available from renowned scientists who acknowledge there is, in this creation, it must be creation. There's no other way. There is such perfect order in the cosmology, there are, let's say, 21 different parameters in which this whole universal creation is, how to say, fixed. Gravity, what they call, have different names for the different forces. So each one has a particular value. If even one value is slightly changed, the whole system would not be existent. So there are so many different ways to prove this point. And it's not, let's say, because in one sense, if you have this understanding, it makes conviction for yourself. We should be convinced, because otherwise, very easily, this is the problem also in some other places, if the devotees have no philosophy, if they don't study this, then very easily sometimes they get actually confused. Like, for example, when this situation happened in America, Prabhupada in the same book, he talks about the moon. That the scientists, the Americans said that they went to the moon. Prabhupada said they didn't go to the moon. They didn't. And now, obviously, now so many years later, they actually documentaries, all that Prabhupada said has been documented and proven. They never went to the moon. But at that time, there were some devotees of his disciples. They were so shaken, they left. Because their understanding was not clear enough. So we should have clear understanding. Also, because otherwise we will be challenged. I was saying the other day, why is this topic at all in Srimad Bhagavatam? This is the most of all sacred scriptures, which is dealing with the holiest of all topics, Krishna Katha, Krishna Leela, etc. Why is there out of a sudden a whole book on cosmic creation, orbits revolving around the planets and the atoms and all this this material, so to say, cosmological knowledge? What does it have to do with spiritual knowledge? One reason being is, if it would not be there, then it would be possible that some people would say, yeah, you people are okay, you have your religion, you have your philosophy, but of practical things you don't understand anything. This is our field. We are scientists, we do the research. And you people do some philosophy and some do some religion. But no, there's expert in this Bhagavatam. It contains all aspects of science, sociology, politology, art, literature. I was talking the other day about this Srimad Bhagavatam. How wonderful it is. You will find, even from a literary point of view, nowadays people are reading novels. You know, Dan Brown, they have big fiction novels, because very popular. But you should go through Bhagavatam and see those plots, those stories, intrigue, love stories, war stories, murder stories. Everything is in there. At the same, with the most fascinating plots. If a screenwriter would take some of those plots and make them into feature movies, it would be amazing. Story of Prahlad Maharaj, how Nrisingadev, such amazing stories. Poetry, it's the most wonderful poetry. If you read some of those descriptions of Krishna entering Dwarka, it is describing the atmosphere, it is describing the city of Dwarka, it is describing the feelings of the residents, of the wives of the residents of Dwarka, in the most flowery poetic language. And especially when it becomes to describing the qualities and the beauty of Krishna. It is the most wonderful poetic language for anyone who is interested in poetry. I know, like, it used to be a big tradition here in India, because the culture was there. They had poetry contests, especially in Bengal. I don't know, maybe in other parts of the country too. But until late, previous century, they always were very famous. People would get together and have poetry contests. And then somebody would recite some poem. And not only were the people able to recite the poem, but the audience was able to appreciate the poem and to appreciate the distinctions between one quality of a poem and another, and give a prize to the best poem writer. So that type of thing is there. And all the different aspects, family life, how to conduct family life, how to overcome difficulties, Like, for example, we have the story of Queen Kunti. Every person is bound to have some calamity in his life. Natural. Soon, at one point, some person to whom he is connected will pass away. Some loved one, father, mother, sometimes even before the parents die, sometimes the children die. Big calamity, big sorrow. Sometimes a rich man, he may lose all his possessions to some unfortunate incident. Big sorrow, big calamity. Then there in the Bhagavatam, there is the story and the example how to deal with such calamity, like Mother Kunti. She prays, please let these calamities come again and again. Why? Because she has realized these calamities have brought me closer to Krishna. So there are so many wonderful examples. But we have to study. This is very important. Krishna consciousness is not a sentimental religion. A lot of sentiment and emotion is there, of course. That is ultimately the purpose. But it is not simply sentimentalism. That was the accusation of the Mayavadi Sannyasis in Mayapur. They were just the Vaishnavas, they are just sentimentalists. They just like to cry and... But we are the learned people. We are the big Swamis who have studied Veda. Let those people cry. Then Lord Chaitanya came. For 7 days or whatever, he was listening to Sarvabhauma Bhattacharya, didn't say a word. And then Sarvabhauma was speaking on Bhagavatam. He said, I'm speaking the whole time, why are you not saying anything? You're not asking any questions? Do you understand anything I say? As Lord Chaitanya said, all I can understand is that you don't understand one thing. So then he explained. He started explaining Bhagavatam. And Sarvabhauma Bhattacharya, the same happened with Prakashananda Sarasvati, were astounded. They thought themselves to be invincible. The most invincible scholars. Nobody could match them. And here comes this young man. Defeats them left and right, up and down. So much so that they could not. There was no, in all their honor, either they had to kill themselves. That was the tradition. Either they had to commit suicide, or if they didn't want to commit suicide, they had to submit. So that's what they did. They became disciples. So, but for that, philosophy has to be learned. It's not... Sometimes, especially in Western countries, I feel that a lot of devotees have become, how to say, complacent to the point simply to chant a little Hare Krishna and do like so the routine Krishna consciousness and settle with that and are satisfied. But that will not be sufficient to save the world. That will be very nice for us. We will be living a peaceful life, but it will not be sufficient to save the world and defeat this rascaldom which is going on, which is causing so much unimaginable suffering throughout the whole world. Anyhow, I think it's enough. Thank you very much. Hare Krishna.